You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. As many of you know by now, because I keep saying it often enough, I tend to be a history buff, and this past year, one of the more interesting books that came across my desk was American Republics, A Continental History of the United States, written by two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author and educator Alan Taylor. And Alan joins me this evening, and we're talking about what I find to be something that I thought we all think, that the 13 original colonies fought to break away from Britain, and then we all got along in a very happy manner. It wasn't quite that way, and for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Alan Taylor about just how difficult it really was to get our direction and our sense of purpose and where we were going as a country. Alan, nice to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me on, Al.
This is, again, all through middle school, all through high school, anytime I picked up a history book, even on my own, the 13 colonies banded together. They wanted to break away from, British rule, British taxation. That made perfect sense to me. I thought, okay, these 13 original colonies were the focal point, the foundation of this country, and they were. But most people think, we were all on the same page. We were harmonious, almost like a family who looked after one another. But after reading American Republics, your new book, I got the sense that, it wasn't quite that easy. And there was a lot of turmoil, a vast amount of differences between regions, who wanted to expand westward, who didn't want to expand, the reasons why Native Americans got involved in the whole picture. Is this something, I'm assuming this is something that caught your interest as well?
Absolutely, because I got the same sort of education you did, which is about American nation emerging very early, Americans developing a very strong identity, and just marching forward, always progressing. And it turns out that the actual history is a lot more interesting, a lot more complicated than that.
Now, I guess it would be fair to say that most people, the 13 original colonies, were people of British descent, right? So, I mean, you would think that everybody would be on the same page. They left the mother country for the same reasons, wanted to start a new life, wanted to get away from British rule. Where were the vast differences when a group of people who had a like background come to the new country and then, when they decide to break away from Britain, don't necessarily have the same goals in mind? How does that happen?
Well, I would disagree with that a little bit, in that the percentage of people born outside of the colonies and born outside of Britain was actually quite high. And Britain was itself a very complicated place. It included the Welsh and the Irish and the Scots. And they didn't think of themselves as English and weren't all that happy with the English a lot of the time. And then there were a lot of Germans who had come over as colonists. And there were Dutch people and Swedish people that had been absorbed within it. And then approximately 20% of the people were Africans, and they were held in slavery. So there's an enormous ethnic and racial diversity in the colonies. You're right that the majority of them are of some sort of British descent, but the proportion of Scots and Irish is going way up, while the proportion of English people is shrinking in the eve of the American Revolution. So figuring out a way to unite these diverse people is going to be a challenge. And then there's great regional diversity. The people of South Carolina don't really think of themselves as the same people as the people of New England. Or even the people of New York had great tensions with the people of New England. So there isn't a common sense of Americanness. There is a sense of, I live in this colony, I'm a Virginian, I'm a Carolinian, I'm a New Englander. And there isn't an American sense. And indeed, until the Revolution, to be called an American was usually something that English people hurled at the colonists as a way to try to make them feel inferior. So it's going to be a challenge when you're embarked on a revolution against British rule to try to find some grounds for unity other than a common enemy. And that's what they're starting with in the revolution. One other thing I just say very quickly is that until we get into Parliament's efforts to tax the colonists, most people were very happy to be part of the British Empire, which was so prosperous and provided civil liberties and provided the best military protection of any empire in the Atlantic world.
Okay, so the as you said, this diversity, first of all, would naturally create variations, differences in mindset as to, you know, where do they want to go as a country once they broke away. Another thing, though, there had to be something that tied people together. And in the book, you mentioned that there was a fear that European nations may want to dominate, even though we broke away from Britain, or take over certain land areas. That seems to be a common point. But as you said, there were differences in ideology. So let me ask you, even today you hear people say, well, the United States thinks it's the, you know, they're the big bully on the global perspective today. So back then, soon after breaking away from Britain and talking about this disharmony within the colonies of the early start of this country, was one region of the country trying to be more dominant than the others? Were New Englanders trying to push their weight around, or somebody else trying to, get the upper hand?
Well, the new Americans, the people who are trying to become Americans, they distrust one another kind of across the board. And they could see the precedents in Europe, where there were a lot of modest-sized countries, and they were engaged in almost continuous conflict over trying to establish a balance of power, with the illusion that that balance of power would maintain peace. But the reality was it just invited lots of wars. So the leaders of this new United States do not want to repeat the history of Europe. They don't want to be a set of warring, petty states. And so the irony of all of this is that out of their fear of one another will come the desire to create a union that will maintain peace between them. And so they create a union, and that union of states is very precious to them because it provides security. The fear is that some particular state or cluster of states within that union will grow too powerful and will become a threat, that they will use that union to dominate the rest of the states. So it's a very tricky balancing act that happens within the union in order to keep from having balance of power wars if they are outside of the union.
You know, the other thing that came to mind, and I've read numerous books on the Civil War, and believe it or not, I mean, I've always thought that just prior to the Civil War, I mean, the South, obviously, plantation owners, many made their money in the cotton fields by owning slaves, and that's really where we come into this slavery, racism kind of thing. But in your book, that becomes quite a topic, does it not? Racism, fear of especially natives coming over to this country and empowering slavery or empowering blacks, and there was a fear. So racism was pretty prominent, was it not?
Yes, and slavery is very prominent in the politics and the economy of the new country. So in the traditional way of telling our history, it seems like everything's working great. You've got this union of the states, the United States, people are Americans, they've got a constitution that they love. And then out of nowhere, it seems, a conflict over slavery emerges in the 1850s, and then we have a civil war, and it's a story that doesn't really make much sense. What I find is that contention over slavery, fear of the difference that having slavery powerful in one region and vanishing in another region, that fears over that are a continuous element in our history that goes back to the Revolution. And the effort at the Constitutional Convention to write this Constitution is complicated greatly by the slave-owning states insisting on certain protections for their system of property to be written into the Constitution. And that ends up almost blowing up the convention. We almost didn't have a constitution or a union over the issue of slavery. And thereafter, Southerners are very defensive about anything they see as changing the Constitution or violating the spirit of the Constitution as they saw it. And ultimately, that's what's going to blow up the United States. So it doesn't just come out of the blue in the 1850s. It's something that's been there all along. Yeah. And then there's an issue of frankly, of racism. The vast majority of white Americans believed that they belonged to a race that was superior to other races, including Native Americans, but especially including African Americans. And so a perverse bond of the Union is that Southerners could appeal to the racism of Northern whites during the 1830s, 1840s, and say, do you really want to liberate our enslaved people because they'll move north and then compete with you for jobs and be your neighbors? Is that really what you want? And for a lot of white Americans, indeed a majority of them in this period, that's a prospect that terrifies them. And so even those Americans who wanted to free the slaves, most of them during this period, meaning before the Civil War, most of them said, you know, if we do free them, we ought to see if we could ship them to Africa, which is an absolute non-starter. It's just absolutely not going to work. But that shows you how desperate they are to reconcile their aversion to slavery with their own conviction that the races could not live together in harmony, which is an enormous problem that Americans do not resolve before the Civil War.
And you make a great, you know, very, very clearly stated throughout the book how clear that you know what may seem like not a big issue as we were forming this nation, as you said, really was you know the launching ground, if you would, for a much larger expanse of you know racism of ideology here in this country. I want to continue on that point, but I do want to take a quick pause to let people know that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. My guest this week is 2-time Pulitzer Prize winning author Alan Taylor. We're talking about his new book, American Republics, A Continental History of the United States. And I said to Alan at the outset, that at least in my mind, I always thought that once this country, broke away from Britain, that we were a cohesive group, just starting to form this new country, and it wasn't quite that way. And in the book, Alan clearly explains the reasons why and the step by step. And going back to those things that we were just talking about, first of all, the Constitution written by white males. You know, I don't know how other countries got formulated. I don't know if it was similar to that. But from your vantage point as a historian, was that problematic that just white males who wanted to hold on to power had all the say in how this country would be formed?
Well, that was standard in the Western world at that time. Certainly the people who are governing the Western European countries are also white men overwhelmingly, though you would have the exception that occasionally a queen would come to power. that's not really challenged much at that time. There are women who are saying, you know, we deserve more respect. We need improved property rights. But in the 1780s, you aren't getting any public voices from women who are pushing for what we would call civil rights or political rights. That's just not yet on the agenda. The fact that the people writing this Constitution are almost all men, not just white and men, but they're men of significant property. They're leading lawyers and landlords and merchants. And so when they write the Constitution, they're very concerned about protecting concentrations of property from what they see as an excess of democracy being practiced by the majority of the voters, who are men of more modest property, who are operating through their state governments. So one of the prime purposes of the Constitution is to provide greater protections for concentrations of property from what the these founders considered to be excesses of democracy in the state governments. So establishing a national government is something that's meant to protect property rights, which they saw were being challenged by state governments that were operating on behalf of the interests of debtors in some states. So there are really two problems the Constitution is addressing. One is the weakness of the national government. It wasn't really a national government before the U.S. Constitution. There was a coordinating Congress of the states, but it didn't have the power to tax. It wasn't capable of sustaining a navy or an army. It wasn't capable of negotiating with foreign governments. So that was a serious problem that they set out to address. But they also see what they regarded as a second problem, which is that the state governments were too powerful and they were sometimes compromising the rights of private property. And so it's to solve those two problems that the delegates drafted the Constitution that ultimately was ratified and is the basis of our government today.
Does those underlying reasons, does that also play into the fact that some wanted to see further expansion, larger growth, more land coming under the title United States, west of the Mississippi and so forth? Because in your book, you know, there's a lot of back and forth. Some saw that as the only way to really establish this nation. Others thought, you know, what do we need to do that for? We're happy the way things are. Things are fine the way they are. So what I'm getting at is expansion of the nation was contentious as well, right?
Well, there's a pretty broad consensus, it's not unanimous, a pretty broad consensus that the population of the United States is doubling approximately every 22 years. It's the fastest growth of population of any significant country in the world. If your population is doubling every 22 years and you want to maintain the same standard of living, and you're overwhelmingly an agricultural country, and 95% of Americans lived on farms or plantations. And they don't really, at that early time, they're not keen to industrialize. So given those facts, you're going to have to expand to maintain the same standard of living so that your sons and your daughters will have farms as fertile and large as the farm you had. So if that's going to happen, you're going to need more land. So there is a fear that there will be growing concentrations of wealth and growing concentrations of poverty that will lead to all sorts of class conflict if you don't expand. Okay, that's a given. But then the issue is, well, in what direction? Now we think about West, and naturally that's true, but there, you know, will it tilt toward the Northwest? Will Canada be absorbed into the United States? Mm-hmm. Or will it tilt toward the Southwest with parts of the Spanish Empire, the future Mexico being absorbed into the United States? So what's contentious is that Northern and Southern representatives in Congress are trying to balance out the regional expansion of the United States so that one region doesn't become more powerful than another. And so that's what creates a lot of difficulties prior to the Civil War within the United States.
And with that said, the people who ended up from my, after finishing the book, what I came away with is that, and we still hear this to this very day, that Native Americans, those who were here first, tribes, who basically, for the most part, just wanted to be left alone, go about their business, were either forced out of their homelands or given promises that were never followed through on. So I get the sense, and I just want to get your feelings on this, that in the book that you two felt that Native Americans probably got they really got a bad deal out of everything.
Oh, absolutely. They're going to lose their homelands. Many of them will lose their lives. They will be under intense pressure to give up their cultures and just be absorbed into the United States. And they don't want to do that. And they're greatly outnumbered. Native populations have greatly shrunken ever since 1492 because of the diseases introduced from Europe and Africa. And so Native peoples are on the defensive. And in their efforts to try to protect themselves, they also have a disadvantage in that they cannot make the firearms that are necessary to resist American expansion. So they seek help from rival empires in North America. They seek help from the British up in Canada. They seek help from the Spanish, who at that time were down in Florida and in Louisiana. And because they're seeking that help, that then makes them even more alarming to the leaders of the United States, who regard Native peoples as the pawns of these rival empires who they feel want to dominate the new United States or want to break it up and even reabsorb parts of the United States. Now, those fears are exaggerated, but fears are very real things, and they motivate people. So the very fact that Native peoples are resisting incorporation into the U.S. and are seeking foreign allies to help them means that they become even more targets of American expansion than they otherwise would have been.
What comes out, Alan, so clearly in the book, and I think bit by bit, you expose this chapter to chapter, in American republics, is the fact, as I said at the outset, everybody thought, well, you know, we broke away from Britain, we're all on the same page, and you talked about, first of all, the differences, because not everybody was from Britain, not everybody was of British origin, that alone, ideologies and different frames of thought, and then you have dealing with Native Americans, then you had dealings with, whether or not we should expand north, should we expand south. So when you put it all together, it doesn't, at least from after finishing the book, you get the sense that how the heck did we ever get to be where we got when there was just so much confusion, there was so much dissension, no one group agreed with the next on every single note. So let me ask you, did you ever get the sense after finishing this book, and I know you've been a historian for years, so you probably have a clearer view of this than anybody else, but did you ever get the sense that how the heck did this country ever get it together?
I'm reading the sources and reading all the contentions that happened along the way, and it can be like, how did this happen that eventually we will have a United States? Now, I'll say a couple things. One is that during the period of the book, there is emerging in parts of the United States, particularly in what we call the Midwest now, or the Middle Atlantic region, and then ultimately also New England, an emerging sense of nationalism. Now, when I say emerging, that means not everybody's on board, but more and more people are on board. But they're mostly on board in the northern states. The South is starting to think, we're a little worried by this emerging sense of nationalism because the majority of the people, it's pretty clear, are living in the North, and they want to use that notion of we're one nation and the majority should rule that one nation. They want to use it in ways that we're not comfortable with. So Southerners ultimately will reject that American nationalism. I say Southerners, most white Southerners. And that's going to lead to the Civil War. So I don't deal directly with the Civil War
right.
in this book, but I'm setting the stage for saying, yeah, American nationalism is growing. And it's that sense of nationalism, of being one nation, and that a majority should rule that one nation, which is, in fact, still quite controversial and is rejected by most white Southerners, that leads to the Civil War. And I'm thinking I may write a sequel to this book that will deal with the Civil War era, and that will show ultimately why so many Northern Americans are fighting for this concept of union. And it's a concept of union that has merged with a sense of being one nation. But it's not at all clear that the union and American nationalism will triumph. It's a real dodgy thing in the Civil War. So if I do get it together to write that book, then that's what it's going to be about.
Well, I for one would love to see a follow-up or a sequel, because you laid the ground. I think you know that you laid the groundwork for, because a lot of people think, well, geez, we were all together. As I said at the outset, once again, everybody thinks that everything was honky-dory up until the North and the South couldn't get their ideologies together. But you know, the seed was planted back during this period that as you mentioned throughout the segment, that there were differences in ideologies, there were differences in how to expand, there were differences in how we'd lead each other's lives. The South wanted one type of life, the North felt something different, even though many started to fall under this umbrella of nationalism. So it really does set the tone. So a sequel would really, at least for me anyway, be a welcome notion. In the quick few moments that we have left, this book, I mean, you've written so many books about the formation of this country, the different periods in this country. Was this particular period most interesting for you?
Well, it's very interesting, but it's also the most painful book for me to write, because you just find these expressions of casual and, frankly, quite vicious and overt racism are just routine on the halls of Congress, in the press. So it can make very painful reading, because we like to think that Americans have, throughout their history, been in touch with the better angels of their character. And it's very difficult. There's a lot of violence in that period, violence in the streets, lots of rioting, riots over controlling elections and voting places, violence against Native peoples, violence against neighboring countries, invasion of Canada, invasion of Mexico, conquest of the northern third of Mexico to add to the United States. It can be difficult. And it can be troubling if we're investing our sense of American identity in a story of continuous progress. And one very savvy historian of an earlier generation said, the United States is the only country born perfect that's been getting better ever since. And I don't think it was born perfect. And I don't think the progress has been continuous. But that's not to say that we don't have reasons today to be very proud. We have reasons to be proud of how much we've overcome over time.
Right.
Now, things aren't perfect now. Everybody knows that. They may differ on in what ways it's not perfect. It's never been perfect. And I don't agree with those who want to beat ourselves up by saying we've strayed from this perfect vision of the founders. Well, the founders were struggling with all sorts of divisions and all sorts of flaws, and they did the best they could.
Right.
But we have had to overcome a lot of things that they couldn't overcome. And so there are reasons to be proud of the progress that's been made in this country over time. And so when Americans look around today and say, look how divided we are, look how polarized we are, we used to be such a united people, well, at times that was true, and I would say World War II is a period of union in the United States. Even during the Cold War, there was more union among Americans than there is now. But we haven't always been that united. In some ways, that period was a bit of an aberration. So I think we could maybe be a little bit more comfortable with the problems we have today. Not that we should accept them, but just accept that Americans have always had to wrestle with very great problems. And there is, over time, when we look at the long run of time, over 2.5 centuries, there are reasons to see that we can continue to make progress in this country. Yeah.
Well put, because I think that's what clearly comes through in Alan Taylor's new book, American Republics. We were not a perfect nation. Things weren't as smooth as many would have believed, and the same. But through those problems, through those challenges, came a great country, and as Alan has said, continues to do so. Alan, real quickly, now people want to reach out to you directly as a way of contacting you or getting more information about your work on both American Republics and other works.
Well, probably through my email is the best way to go. And so that's the letters A, S, and T, which are my initials, so AST. Then the number 8, followed by the letter F, as in Frank. So AST8F at virginia.edu is the best way to reach me.
Great. And that way, you know, Alan would love to hear from people, especially about the new book, American Republics, A Continental History of the United States, and the formation. And so clearly, as Alan has explained, we were not a perfect nation. We continue to not be a perfect nation, but over time, we work together to form a better nation. I don't want to sound, like someone who's got their thing together. We are a great nation, and I think sometimes we lose sight of that. And as Alan said, there'll always be challenges, but if we work together and we push together, we can solve anything and many of the problems that affect this nation. If you have any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the Public Eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you so much for tuning in.